Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the global hunt for Al-Qaeda, it has been a month of eye-catching headlines from Karachi to Singapore to Buffalo, New York. The key word is arrests, and lots of them. Is Osama bin Laden's terrorist network taking a real hit? Or, despite the headlines, are we just scratching the surface? In this hour, who's winning the war with Al-Qaeda? We begin in Hamburg, Germany. The plans for 9/11 began in Hamburg with Mohammed Atta, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and their angry circle. Bin al-Shib, the only known surviving member of the hijacked planning team, now faces 3,000 counts of murder in Germany for his backstage role in the attacks. Cordula Meyer is a reporter for the German news magazine Der Spiegel. I asked her what made Hamburg so hospitable to the terrorists.
It is an open city, it's a harbor city, and there are a lot of people from different places from all over the world living there. And also the people of Hamburg, they mind their own business. If people want to be left alone, they leave them alone. So they were able to lead their lives very separate from the other people here.
And in recent days and weeks, we've come to learn an enormous amount about the Al-Qaeda network and cell that was in Hamburg. Why? Why has all this information come to light?
There's a lot of information just accumulating. We have now new information from Mohammed Haider Sama, who has been questioned in Syria. We have the interview that Ramzi bin al-Shib has given on Al Jazeera.
This is the so-called 20th hijacker,
yes.
Who was arrested just a few days ago in Pakistan.
Exactly.
And who was Mohammed Atta's roommate and best buddy in Hamburg.
Exactly. They've been together for a long time, and they spent time at the Islamic group at the university, which is also where we got new information about how, not so much about the hierarchy and how the group worked, but on how the mind of the terrorists worked. That gave an insight how they thought about us, the good Muslims versus the infidels.
So tell us, what are the most important things that have been learned from all the investigation going on in Hamburg about the mind and workings of Al-Qaeda there?
I think it's pretty safe to say now that Ramzi bin al-Shib was the 20th hijacker. He was the only guy who came to Germany with a mission. He came first as an asylum seeker, and then he headed back and posed as a student. But the other members of the cell came to Germany to study, and then they were later recruited, and piece by piece they were radicalized. They went to the mosques, listened to the very radical prayers and preachers over there. And so piece by piece, they get more and more hyped up in this feeling like we have to do something for the Muslims. The Muslims are suppressed all over the world, and there's a responsibility we have to do something against that. And that's, I think, is a very scary part. All that happened right in Hamburg.
Cordula Meyer, let's back up for just a moment. We often hear about Zacharias Massawi, referred to as the 20th hijacker. Now, Ramzi bin al-Shib has been giving the same kind of tagline. Who was he? Where did he come from? Why was he sent to Hamburg? And was he supposed to be on one of the flights on September 11?
He came from Yemen to Hamburg, at first in 1995 as an asylum seeker. And from all what we know at this point, he was or had already connections to Al-Qaeda. He was sent back because he wasn't accepted in Germany as an asylum seeker because he had a, we now know, wrong story that he was arrested when he was a student in Sudan. So then later he came back with his real name, Ramzi bin al-Shib. He lived in the apartment with Mohammed Atta, and he applied to the same flying school in Florida that Siad Jarrah attended. That was before Zacharias Massawi was even in the picture. So I think the first plan was to send Ramzi bin al-Shib to be the fourth pilot. He applied for a U.S. visa and was turned down four times. So only after this fell through, they were looking for Zacharias Massawi to take his part.
You describe how Al-Qaeda recruited young Muslims in Hamburg and the area to be part of the plot. Does it seem from what's been learned in Germany that that was difficult, or were these young men susceptible to the allure of Al-Qaeda and terrorism?
This is, for me personally, very, very surprising and unsettling fact. We have learned that so many young Muslims went to the camps in Afghanistan. It's not just the four people of the cell or the six people, if you also count the supporters, but the investigators have now learned that there are many, many more. The number are in the hundreds. So there must be a potential where Al-Qaeda is drawing these people from. And a lot of it seems it's just coincidence. Take Ziad Jarrah. He was such a westernized, modern guy. He was more westernized than some people living here. I mean, he was drinking, he was going out, he was going to the nightclubs in Beirut.
Living the full European life.
Absolutely.
But he was drawn into this dance with death.
Absolutely. For him, I think it was almost like a sect. He was maybe lonesome, so this strong cell here in Hamburg provided some guidance and some comfort. And that's my explanation how this guy especially was drawn into the group.
If that's what gave Al-Qaeda its strong drawing power, what has been learned about Al-Qaeda's vulnerabilities through the investigation in Hamburg?
I think Al-Qaeda profited hugely because the investigators and the intelligence agencies, they didn't look for Al-Qaeda. I mean, they had different things on their minds here. They were interested in right-wing German political activity. If they were interested in Islamic activity, they were looking at the big Turkish groups that we have over here. But Al-Qaeda, it was just not the highest priority.
But now, as they've begun to unravel it, is it coming apart? Are they dismantling the Al-Qaeda cell in Hamburg, the Al-Qaeda network in Germany? What's your sense?
In Hamburg, from what we know, the people are either dead or, well, Ramzi bin al-Sheikh is now arrested, but two are still at large. And then there's a supporter community. But some of the people are under investigation. With some other people, there isn't even a formal investigation. But because in Germany it's very difficult to follow these people in a lawful sort of way, it's not forbidden to be friends with the terrorists. You walk a very fine line between this supporting a terrorist organization and just having contact.
Given all that, do the authorities in Germany think that Hamburg remains a potential base for terrorist activity today?
I wouldn't think so because they are under immense observation there. Because there was a group that was meeting in a Hamburg bookstore and they were talking about being martyrs and things like that. The police didn't have much more than that, but they immediately went in there and raided the place and arrested the people just to give them a signal. We know that you are there. We are watching you. So the chances that something like the Hamburg cell, like Atta cell, goes undetected are pretty low at this point.
The United States has obviously been a target of a major terrorist hit. Do German authorities feel that Germany itself could be a target for a significant terrorist attack?
When you listen to the preachings and the hatred and all that is preached in this place, the U.S. is the target because they are very much outraged about the U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia and the U.S. as the main superpower who they feel colonized the Arab world and all kinds of things. So I think the U.S. is going to remain a prime target here. I think the situation would change if Germany would take part in the war in Iraq, possibly. It could be a target, but it's much more likely that the U.S. remains the main target.
Cordula Meyer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Cordula Meyer is a reporter for the German news magazine Der Spiegel. She spoke with me earlier today from Hamburg. Last week, Pakistani intelligence officials collared Ramzi bin al-Sheikh, a central player in planning the attacks in New York and Washington. From Indonesia, Omar al-Farouk is now in custody and telling all, we're told, about embassy bombings and assassination plans in Southeast Asia. In Buffalo, New York, six Yemeni American citizens, are being held for their involvement in the only known alleged al-Qaeda cell in the United States. Tonight, we're weighing the significance of the recent spate of arrests. Is Al-Qaeda on the run in Pakistan, in Singapore, in Indonesia, even in our own backyard? Or are we just getting started here? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Jessica Stern. She's public policy lecturer at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government and the author of The Ultimate Terrorists. Good evening and welcome, Jessica Stern.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. Jessica, put this spate of arrests and activity and headlines and a little bit of bragging put on top of it by Washington, I guess. Are we making progress? Are we breaking the back of al-Qaeda? How significant is this flurry of arrests and announcements that we've heard in the last 2-3 weeks?
Well, I think it's very significant. We've really obviously made a lot of headway in the last couple of weeks. But it's important to remember that these are really tactical successes. The long-term battle is really a battle of the story. These are tactical successes. The long-term battle is really over hearts and minds and how we can prevent disgruntled, lonely, humiliated young men from joining this cause.
Now, that's a very interesting observation, Jessica Stern. You're saying tactical in that, yes, there are arrests. Yes, important players are taking out of play. But the story is the key thing. Are you suggesting that even if we break the organization of al-Qaeda, we've still got a terrorism problem?
Well, yes, of course we do. We have a terrorism problem, even from domestic groups in the United States. But
there's some we've learned or thought we'd learned to live with, and others that we thought on 9/11 were simply intolerable, that we could not live with, were even mortal threats.
Right. And let me be clear. I think that we've had a lot of successes, tactical successes in our war against al-Qaeda. But we have certainly not broken the back of al-Qaeda. In fact, I think the successes have shown one of the drawbacks to the policy we've pursued so far, an unfortunate side effect of our success in Afghanistan is that al-Qaeda is now more active elsewhere in Pakistan and in Southeast Asia.
Help us get a sense of that scale of success so far, then, Jessica Stern. We read Western diplomats talking about now moving on to break up the remnants of al-Qaeda. Are we really in that position? Have we kind of broken the back of the bulk of it and its remnants we're dealing with? Or are we just scratching the surface? Or do we even know?
Well, unfortunately, the problem is much bigger than al-Qaeda itself. I mean, the group seems to have established franchises in various parts of the world, in particular in Southeast Asia, and it's taking advantage of groups that have a regional agenda but are willing to fight this anti-American, anti-globalization cause. So a good example is Jamaat Islamiyah, the group that has been very actively involved with al-Qaeda, and that's come out recently. This is a group that wants to create an Islamic society, an Islamic state in Southeast Asia.
And we read the Singaporean officials say kind of a pan-Southeast Asian state that would subsume Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, parts of the Philippines.
Right. So it has its own local agenda, but it's willing and indeed happy to assist al-Qaeda with its broader effort. And there are other groups that fall into the same category. They have regional objectives. Perhaps they're fighting for greater representation vis-a-vis Christians.
But if al-Qaeda, that organization, as far as we can define it, is broken, does that kind of pull the power supply on these others? Or is there some genie out of the bottle that works whether or not we break al-Qaeda's back?
I'm inclined to think that to a large extent, this is a long, I don't know if I would call it a genie out of the bottle, but this is a long-term effort. This is something we're going to have to live with for a long time. And I also want to emphasize that I'm not saying that we've broken al-Qaeda's back. I don't feel that I know that. I mean, repeatedly I get email messages from Pakistan from people who claim to know that bin Laden himself is still active in somewhere in Afghanistan.
There's a mystery here. Jessica Stern, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back. We're talking about the war and al-Qaeda, the reality behind the headlines. You've heard the drumbeat of arrests, but do you feel confident we are cleaning up al-Qaeda? Is the war on terror being won? Are we making real progress? Do you feel you have any idea? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the war on Al-Qaeda, trying to get at the reality behind the headlines. You've heard that drumbeat of arrests. You've read about it. But do you feel confident that we are cleaning up, that we are effectively addressing the Al-Qaeda terror network? And what about the arrests of American citizens outside Buffalo? Are you shocked or not surprised? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Jessica Stern. She's a public policy lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Ultimate Terrorists. And now by Elaine Shannon. She's criminal justice correspondent for Time magazine. Good evening and welcome, Elaine Shannon.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Elaine Shannon, if you could rank order the developments of the last couple of weeks for us. What's really important here, and what's fluff, if there's such a thing, in the pile of headlines we're looking at?
Well, I think the case in Buffalo is very important, but I cannot tell you yet, and the FBI can't tell you, that these men are terrorists, and if left to their own devices, would do something terrible. It is significant, however, that they, at least two of them, have confessed that they traveled to Afghanistan in the summer of 2001. They took training and weapons. They saw others training and weapons, including anti-aircraft weapons. Mm-hmm. Heard a lecture from Osama bin Laden. And then when the FBI got a tip about it, lied and said, no, they'd only been in Pakistan doing religious training. Of course, their defenders say, well, they were curious and they were kind of on a lark. And
just sucked in at the margins.
Well, I said to an FBI agent up there, what about this? And he said, well, you know, everybody said Tim McVeigh was a good boy, too, and would never do anything like that. And he was from Buffalo. So you can't make any assumptions. And we still don't know what these folks were all about. But I think it's very important. I think the other very important development, which we found out about and featured in Time magazine, mm-hmm. was the debriefing of a senior Al-Qaeda operative named Omar Al-Farouk,
who is in Indonesia.
He was arrested in Indonesia. He's a Kuwaiti. He was sent by Al-Qaeda Central to Indonesia to be the regional representative from Al-Qaeda to the indigenous radical Muslim fundamentalist groups.
And as you write it up in Time, his own wife never knew.
So she says. That's possible.
Mm-hmm. He is now has been for several months, being interrogated by Americans where?
Oh, they won't say. The CIA's got him somewhere out, I think, in the region. Or he was taken to Bagram Air Force Air Base.
Near Kabul. And you've reported that after 3 months of stoic resistance, he is said to have broken, to be spilling the beans, whatever those are.
Yes. I don't know exactly why. Maybe it was isolation. Maybe it was because he just never saw anybody but Americans and thought others were talking. But what we got was a report of a debriefing that he gave on September 9, in which he said, yes, he was the Al-Qaeda man in Indonesia with liaison also with Malaysia and Singapore and links to radicals in the Philippines, and that a big religious figure in Indonesia named Abu Bakar Bashir, head of the Indonesian version of
Jamaah Islamiyah.
It's called Jamaah Islamiyah. Islamiyah.
Thanks, Jessica.
Had ordered hits, bombings, explosions at U.S. embassies all over the region. And Al-Farouk gave a lot of detail, talked about a sort of a continuity of government plan, as if he was taken off, that others would step forward to carry out this plot. And they described how much money they had and how much explosives and where they'd gotten it.
And Elaine Shannon, how seriously has this idea of a kind of pan-regional push to an Islamic state being taken? I mean, I spent a lot of time in that region. At one time, that would have been heard as the most quixotic, absurd dream ever.
Well, there have been some bombings that have been successful. Others have been thwarted. There's conflict among the governments of those nations, and I don't know how well each individual little group gets along with each individual other little group across the border. But one thing we know about Al-Qaeda is that there are people from all different nations that go to camps there and seem to get along and do stuff together.
And Ramzi bin al-Shib picked up in Karachi. How important?
That's very important. He knows the whole story of 9/11. He's thought to have been in communication in very recent days with the top leadership of Al-Qaeda. I don't know, can't say for sure Bin Laden, but he gave an interview on camera or on tape, I guess, with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's a senior figure who is thought to be one of the masterminds behind 9/11. So he knows what's coming as well as what how they put the 9/11 together. Mm-hmm.
Jessica Stern, when you look at these three major areas, how do you rank them in terms of importance? We've got here a regional mastermind in Southeast Asia, we're told. We've got one of the central planners of 9/11. And very disturbingly, we have American citizens outside Buffalo. How do you stack up the significance of these?
Well, I think all three are significant. I'm not sure I'm prepared to rank them. I think it's important to bear in mind how Al-Qaeda works, that it's not it's common for Al-Qaeda members to go into a region and try to recruit locals who speak the language mm-hmm. and can really fit in well. And they find them in mosques, and then these boys are sent to Afghanistan. Similar, I mean, I'm thinking now of Khalfan Khamis Mohammed, who had been in Zanzibar and was recruited out of Dar es Salaam, largely because of his ability to translate for them and help them with the bombing in Dar es Salaam.
And give them a local face.
Right, and he was brought to the camp. He never joined Al-Qaeda, but these camps kind of serve as a way to develop networks of trust.
A node, a pod, and then the contractor goes out in a way.
And doesn't even know what he will be tasked for eventually, or even whether he'll be tasked eventually.
Elaine Shannon, do you hear U.S. authorities talking about how deeply into the Al-Qaeda network they believe they've waded at this point? Are we scratching the surface? Are we getting near the heart of things? Do we have any idea?
Well, I think that what's troubling about all of this is that as was just pointed out, there's many different layers that people can go to the camps and then get approval from somebody in Pakistan or Afghanistan who's higher up, or they can freelance something, or they can recruit people locally and train them themselves. There's the Al-Farouk interrogation mm-hmm. gave us an idea that Al-Qaeda was a lot more organized. And the Southeast Asian groups were a lot more organized with people with titles and responsibilities than maybe a lot of people had the impression. Still, there are many different reasons somebody who's angry and who wants to do something bad can do it. And the communications links aren't such that the U.S. can intercept them and head that off, because they don't know what they are.
Jessica Stern was talking earlier about the sort of the broader nimbus, the sort of penumbra of terrorists or terrorist candidates around Al-Qaeda. President Bush looks at it in a more kind of linear way. He said, we're picking them off one by one, which seems to present, here we've got a fixed target and we're going to knock them down till they're gone, and that will be that. You're talking with people who are working with these problems, Elaine Shannon. Do they have that kind of confidence that there's...
No. No, they talk about the people that they worry about the way drug agents talk about the drug trade. It's the concept of the ant army, that, yeah, you may take out this cell or that group, but there are going to be plenty more where that come from.
Jessica Stern, this sounds like the carnival game where the head pops up in so many places that no amount of hammers can knock it down.
Yeah, I do think this is a very, very long-term effort, and we've had some very impressive tactical successes in the last couple of weeks, and that's great, and I think it's something to feel really good about. We've been getting extraordinary cooperation in terms of intelligence and law enforcement internationally, but it is this big problem based on humiliation, discontent, hopelessness, rage, especially in the Islamic world.
And it really sounds at the heart of what you're saying is, though, it's not just that it's a long-term challenge. It sounds as though you're saying it's a challenge that just may not answer to the kind of policing we're talking about. I think a lot of Americans have somewhere in the back of their minds a notion of going after the mafia or the mob, and if you just knock out enough of its management structure, it kind of crumbles. You're saying no.
I think it is, in a way, a side effect of globalization that we're just going to have to deal with. That globalization has made our lives easier and better in many ways, but this is the kind of downside of globalization. Technological change. Technology has also improved our lives, but it's made it easier for individuals and small groups to have the same kind of effects that used to be only available to states.
But it makes policing sound critical, but somehow woefully insufficient. Jay's on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom.
Good evening.
What I'm getting from some of the shows, and basically with this so-called expert, we get too much information. A few days later, it turned out to be nothing. For example, I have heard so far on four different people supposedly be a 20th hijacker. I figure that 20th is only one number. Either then got to be more numbers. If Zakaria Mousavi was 20th, what's Al-Shib is doing? What's Al-Furuq is doing?
Well, in fairness, Jay, at least in the case of bin Al-Shib and Mousavi, there was clear what happened. One couldn't get in and another was substituted.
Now, what about these people in Buffalo? Today, judge says, no, they're not really a threat. What about those other people in Florida? That today report was that obviously those students were going to school, and one other thing they were talking about it in the restaurant, taking their car to school. And one more comment, Tom.
Yes.
If terrorists going to plan something big,
mm-hmm.
I ask you, do you think they're going to discuss that in a restaurant?
Well, we know that one turned out, as it happened, to be nothing. But thanks for your observation, Jay. And Elaine Shannon, let me put it to you. Here's a suggestion that these things are sensationalized, that the public is hungry for scalps, and so scalps are presented. But I don't hear that from you. I hear you saying these are significant arrests.
Well, but there's also a heck of a lot of sensationalizing out there. I'm just sitting here working on this item about these. There are some Sudanese men mm-hmm. who have been detained on immigration charges, and they are being questioned by the FBI. One of them is supposedly trained as a pilot, and there is some concern about whether they have connections to the Al-Qaeda movement, because Al-Qaeda was located in Sudan for a long time. But when it first came out this morning, it was a Sudanese pilot came into Canada, and he crossed the border in the United States, and he had a plan to get a plane and crash it into the White House, and he couldn't be found. He was out someplace loose. In fact, there is a guy who's in the INS detention somewhere, and I've talked to the FBI, I've talked to the White House, we've talked to the CIA, and I've talked to several other places, and they don't know whether these people have nefarious motives or they're just out of status.
So you think they are significant arrests, but
the Buffalo case, I think, is very interesting. I don't know, if when you have two people who are making confessions that they went to the camps, I think that's very interesting. I think it's particularly interesting since they are all but one of them is a born U.S. citizen, and then one is natural. The eighth is naturalized. To me, that's a fascinating insight into recruitment patterns. Al-Qaeda certainly wants to get Americans, French, Brits, others with passports that can get into the United States that don't need visas. But these people, what they actually intended to do, whether they were just listening and got trapped in there and couldn't get out and felt bad but then got scared and didn't want to tell the authorities, that's their defense.
It's easy
could
to
be true.
It's easy to imagine that picture. Jessica Stern, how about the the guys outside Buffalo. One is tempted to want to tread lightly here, not read too much into it too quickly. But how do you see it, and how do you assess the risk of a kind of indigenous American citizen population of terrorists either being in place or arising?
Yeah, well, obviously we can't say exactly how significant the situation in Buffalo is. I mean, there is, of course, this problem that the government would like to make it look as though it's succeeding very dramatically. Mm-hmm. So the caller, I would agree with the caller about that. But the trend, I think we can say something about the trend, and that is that this is not the first time we have heard of foreigners having been brought, Americans or Europeans or Brits in particular, having been brought to camps in Afghanistan. There are thousands of people who have gone through those camps and could be sleepers, and I imagine we will discover many more Americans that have done this, even if it turns out that these young men in Buffalo were just basically going on a very unusual vacation.
And Elaine Shannon, I know we have to lose you in a moment, but what's your sense of the resources being thrown at the Al-Qaeda network now, at terrorism in general? Can you feel a surge? Is it palpable?
Well, sure. When I talk to agents or investigators, that's just about what they do for a living now. On the other hand, if you watch the Senate hearings today or read about them or look at them on the Internet on C-SPAN, and I recommend them to people, they were quite somber. You realize how far the FBI and the CIA have to go. Now, we don't want a police state, and we don't, even the KGB wasn't successful in going after a lot of things they wanted to get, like drugs and black marketeering and probably a lot of other bad stuff, and they weren't successful in Chechnya. So we don't want, or it wouldn't work anyway, we don't want that kind of state. But I know that the agencies aren't able to get through all the material that's been seized in Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's just terabytes of material on servers up here that haven't been translated and analyzed.
Mm. What a picture. Elaine Shannon, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Elaine Shannon is criminal justice correspondent for Time magazine. We're talking tonight about the war on Al-Qaeda, about the reality behind the headlines. Does the terrorist threat still seem real to you? Do you tell yourself that the major threat has passed? And what about Osama bin Laden? Does he matter anymore? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'll be back in just a moment with Jessica Stern from the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the war on Al-Qaeda, on terrorism, about the reality behind the headlines. You've heard that drumbeat of arrests. Do you feel confident we are cleaning up Al-Qaeda, stopping terror? Does war on Iraq help or hurt or distract? And Congress has seriously criticized pre-9/11 intelligence efforts. Do you believe it's better now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Jessica Stern. She's a public policy lecturer at the Kennedy School of Government and author of The Ultimate Terrorist. And we're joined on the line now by Noor. Welcome, Noor. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Good evening, Tom. How are you doing?
Well, thank you.
I believe that I have a comment and I have a question at the same time.
Okay.
I believe that there's 7 million Muslims in America.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, those people living in America in a very peaceful way, they have no hatred against anybody. But my question, even add, you know, the number of Arabs, whether Christian or you know, just, you know, Arabs in
All
America,
right.
That
yep.
will add to the 7 million. And when you look at the media and you see last week, you know, this week, three doctors and they have been detained because, you know, they have plots against, you know, the American society. What I would like to explain that, you know, the 7 million Muslims and of course, you know, the Arabs.
Yes, what about them, Noor? What about them?
Okay, they living here, you know, in a very peaceful society.
And?
Those people, the 20 hijackers, came to America. They came with anger. They came with hatred. And they came with a mission in their mind to achieve.
So, Noor, are you saying that American Muslims are immune to that anger and mission, or that they're vulnerable to it?
I think, you know, what I feel that, you know, the when the media talk a lot about, you know, those three doctors and, you know, the other...
You mean the kids who were stopped on the highway in Florida? But take us to your point, Noor. I'm missing it so far.
My point is... I think, you know, the media creating a hostile situation for the Muslim people in America. Those people, they are actually, they have a lot of respect for the American society. They're working hard to survive as good citizens in America. And when you look at the media creating kind of like, you know, you should, you know, look at those Muslims and Arabs like suspicious.
I think we've got the gist of it, Noor, and thank you for your call. Jessica Stern, what about this? It's a difficult and delicate thing to think about, to talk about, but how vulnerable do you see the American Muslim community or portions thereof to the allure of terrorism?
Well, I think the first thing to point out is that the worst victims of the September 11th crimes were peaceful Muslims all over the world, not just American Muslims.
Fair enough.
Muslims in general. Are American Muslims susceptible? I think that young men who feel hopeless and angry are susceptible.
Hopeless and angry about what? In suburban Buffalo.
Well, as it happens, it looks as though the economic situation was not that great. But mm-hmm. I think it's generally true that people who feel hopeless and angry and despairing and lack a sense of identity and feel for whatever reason repeatedly humiliated are vulnerable. And that's true.
But does that apply to does that apply to American Muslims for some particular reason? What reason? I mean, before 9/11, I can't say that I have any recollection of American Muslims being singled out for mistreatment.
Well, you're not really asking about being singled out for mistreatment. I think you're asking about being singled out for recruitment. And I think that terrorists tend to go after people who feel humiliated, disgruntled, angry, dissatisfied. That applies both to Muslims and to identity Christians and to what terrorists are good at this. They figure
but
it out.
Is this an anger? Is this a frustration that kind of spans from the Middle East right into American communities? Is it the same anger and frustration felt in the Middle East? Is it based in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or something else?
Well, I don't. I think it's important to realize that people from many different political perspectives were at least claimed to have been sympathetic to bin Laden's objectives. Neo-Nazis have said that they're sympathetic. Quite a few neo-Nazis were applauding bin Laden's actions. Ironically, some of the anti-globalist anarchists are joining forces with neo-Nazis and Islamists. So it's about rage, I think, as much as it is about politics. Politics is important, but rage and humiliation and frustration and anger are also important.
Those are just adjectives that I would not have associated with the Arab American community or the American Muslim community before last fall. Maybe I was just missing something.
Well, I think those are adjectives that apply to human beings. Every human being is susceptible to those feelings at different times. I don't think that it's something particular about American Muslims. What makes American Muslims attractive to Al-Qaeda is mm-hmm. that they have passports and can fit in here.
Yep. Jack is on the line. Welcome, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Well,
I just have a quick comment that I just want to say that the administration can do everything to flex its muscle and tear up all the al-Qaeda networks it can. These people are not going to stop coming. When their networks are torn up, they're going to come at us as individuals. They're sociopaths.
Well, so what's the answer, Jack? Whether or not they clearly end up sociopaths, but they don't start that way. We're all born fresh. What's the answer here?
Well, a lot of it's the policy. These are they feel disenfranchised. It's a generational thing. There's thousands of the terrorists in training. They're probably 5 years old, and they'll get us in 15 years. You know what I'm saying? It's the brainwashing, the social brainwashing that they undergo is not going to stop. The pounding that we gave them in Afghanistan is only going to firm their resolve.
We've got it, Jack, and it certainly sounds like policing is by no means enough. Rose is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I'm very concerned about what I see as our overall aggression. I think, very much in keeping with your speaker, that I think there are a lot of frustrated people all over the world. I think there's a lot of frustrated people in this country. I think the economic divide is getting very great. And I'm really concerned about our president, who seems to take a cavalier and cowboy attitude. So I think, you know, Iraq is a great distraction from our war on terrorism. I think we're going to be breeding more terrorists. I think we have how we've handled a lot of our foreign policy. And it's greatly concerning to me. And many of us here in Madison, I know, talk and feel very helpless to put any kind of lid on this activity.
Well, understanding is the first step. And Rose, thank you for your question. It's a great issue. I want to get it to Jessica Stern. Jessica, what about the war in Iraq? You're the terrorism expert. Does the war in Iraq help or hurt? Does it distract? Can we have a full-fledged effort against terrorism and war in Iraq at the same time?
Well, I am anxiously waiting to see what comes out on Tuesday when Tony Blair puts out at least something about intelligence available to him, to the U.S. and to the U.K. government.
You mean about what's going on inside Iraq and potentially about terrorist links there?
Yes. I think there must be something going on that we don't know about. I want to give the administration the benefit of the doubt.
But even if there is some link there, does going to war there, in your professional estimation, help the overall effort or pull the focus away from the broader problem? What's your assessment?
Well, if there is indeed a link, and it must be a pretty strong link, then I can understand the justification. I can understand why the administration would feel it necessary to engage in preventive war. But how will it affect the broader effort? It will significantly damage it. So
the broader effort against terrorism.
Yes. I mean, we have to make a...
This is the Scowcroft perspective.
Yes, I mean, I think whenever we every policy remedy that we design always has countervailing dangers, always entails countervailing dangers, unintended side effects, and no question that a war in Iraq would alienate our allies, and I certainly assist bin Laden in his efforts to turn this into a war between Islam and the West.
That's Jessica Stern, we're out of time, but it's so great to have you. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Sounds like a long road. Jessica Stern is public policy lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School and author of The Ultimate Terrorists. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, restoring the American Republic the Jeffersonian way. This is On Point. Former Senator and presidential candidate Gary Hart says Americans need to step up and take back control of their government. In his latest book, Restoration of the Republic, Hart says Americans should revive Thomas Jefferson's ideals of citizen responsibility, a neighborhood republic where Americans lead their own governance, their own security, their own defense. Hart spoke at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education earlier this week, and tonight we bring you an excerpt from that speech.
Constitutional scholars here recognize that the Constitution created two armies. One was the what we would call the regular army, the Hamiltonian army, more or less, a standing army navy, in his words, to protect our commercial interests abroad. But they also created a second army, or acknowledged its existence at least, Article 1, Section 8, the militia. We don't call them that anymore for a lot of different reasons, but the militia belongs to the states. And in the late 19th century, the militia got to be called the National Guard. The 20th century, the National Guard transposed itself and was transposed into a follow-on expeditionary force for the regular army. So if we went to war in World War I or World War II or Korea, somewhere else, the regulars went and the Guard went right behind them with a vengeance in World War II. And the Guard in the last century defined its role as a follow-on expeditionary force fighting wars abroad. Then came 9/11. And now the security of this nation is dependent on the National Guard. We recognize that in our report. The president himself has recognized it. The Guard is dragging its feet because it's still thinking in the 20th century. But it is now the front line of the defense of this country, both because that's its job in the Constitution, second, because Congress in 1878, in the last razor-thin national election, passed a law called the Posse Comitatus Act, which absolutely forbids the uniformed regular army from enforcing the laws of this nation. And for a third reason, a practical reason, the Guard is dispersed already around the country and properly trained and equipped. It can help in defending this nation against future terrorist attacks. If you believe, as the ancient Greeks believed, that the citizen soldier, in those days pretty much a farmer, when attacked, dropped the plow and picked up the shield and sword and defended the city-state, history has come full circle in 2,800 years. The front line of security of this country is now the citizen soldier, a key element for the performance of civic duty, civic virtue. And it's not just the Guard. It's emergency medical workers. It's people skilled in prevention of attacks of various kinds. It's people particularly skilled in the response to biological or chemical attacks or even nuclear. In effect, it's all of us. And that is part of what restoring the republic is all about. So at least in some limited ways, what I'd like to argue here today is because of the need to restore the other side of the political coin, to earn our rights by performance of our duties, because of the changing and revolutionary nature in the change of the nature of conflict. All of these things now set the stage, I think, for us to begin to think seriously about restoring those values of the republic that have been too long lost.
Former Senator and presidential candidate Gary Hart, he spoke earlier this week at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. His new book is Restoration of the Republic, the Jeffersonian Ideal in the 21st Century America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is W.